From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City, otherwise known as Little Manila.
Lower Hay.
Outer Richmond.
Fremont.
South of Market.
The Marina.
The E.
Truro Hill. The Dirty 94107.
I'm from Israel, live in Santa Clara.
Coming up, we continue our coverage of life after prison.
I was only 17. I stayed with my mom before I went to prison, so this is my first time being on my own freedom. It felt real good.
Then we'll have a conversation about what economics are driving the Bay Area economy. Kind of.
San Francisco is hot right now, and that is really driven by this demographic shift we're seeing. You know, young technical talent, they want to be in urban centers. They don't want to be out in the suburbs. In fact, these folks don't even want to drive.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Today, we're going to meet two men who are recently released from prison and find out how they're coping with life on the outside. Before we get to them, here's a little background. California has one of the highest prison populations in the country, and high recidivism rates as well. Right now, those who are released from prison have over a 60% chance of returning within a 3-year period. So what makes it so hard to stay out of custody? William Bennett spent most of his adult life in prison, 31 years to be exact. About a year and a half ago, Bennett was released. That's meant quickly developing life skills that usually come over time. Things like how to negotiate a salary, find an apartment, connect with family. Now, at the age of 51, he has to learn and learn fast. KALW's Louisa Beck brings us the first of a series of stories chronicling Bennett's reentry to society. Today, we'll hear about the challenges he and his friend John Porter face in finding a place to live. And a note for our listeners, the names of those released from prison in this story have been changed to protect their privacy.
It's hard to tell William and John's age based on looks. William is about 6 feet, wears a silver ear stud, and a signature cologne, Gypsy Musk. John is a little shorter. He has big eyes, a small gap in his upper teeth, and a huge friendly grin. Both of them have this determined and yet playful air about them. When they showed me the kitchen they share with 12 other guys, they started the kind of banter that only two trusted friends can get away with.
So who's the better cook out of both of you?
I'm the better cook.
I am.
I'm the better cook because I used to cook for everybody in the penitentiary. I came out here and I cooked for everybody out here. He's not telling the truth. I always cook.
William and John do their cooking in a shared kitchen that's part of a transitional house in West Oakland. But they met many years ago.
Well, we were actually in prison together for many years.
Okay.
We did a lot of time together.
Okay.
Yeah, we did about 20 years.
John and William went to prison for murder. Each was on drugs at the time he shot a person. John served 27 years in state prison. William served 31.
I got out November 1st, 2012.
Mm-hmm. I got out February 21st. 2013, mm-hmm. And I put in to go to the Options program.
Options Recovery Services provides clean and sober housing for people who are either recovering from substance abuse or re-entering society from prison. The program has 10 houses in Oakland and Berkeley. And this particular house in West Oakland looks a lot like all the other family-style houses in the neighborhood. It's got a front porch, white wooden panels, and a stairway leading up to the entrance. It's hard to tell from the outside that at any point in time, 14 to 20 men live here. The men give me a tour of the house. A chore list with over a dozen names hangs in the kitchen, and the computer, chairs, and piano in the living room are all shared.
This is my shelf right here.
Okay.
I share this shelf with someone else. And, you know, sometimes guys come in and they take food, but I don't never say anything. If a guy's so hungry that he needs to steal food, you know, if he feels that he's too proud to ask for it, that he needs to steal food, you know, I don't. Some guys get mad when people steal their food, but I don't.
While John and William appreciate having a roof over their heads, this is one of the criticisms they have of Options Transitional Housing.
You have two types of people this year. You have lifers like us that came out. We're all trying to do positive things, trying to do the right thing. Then you have other people here that's real addicts. Mm-hmm. So they're liable to relapse?
Well, I would disagree. I think it's good for them to meet the people just coming off the streets.
Dr. Davida Cody is the executive director of Options.
I think it's good for the people just coming off the streets to meet them particularly. I think having a diverse population is good for people in recovery.
She started Options 16 years ago because at the time, there were no services available to people who had little money but who were suffering from addiction. A lot of former lifers choose Options over other programs because it's one of the few places that will accept them even before they get out of prison.
Many of the prisoners tell us that they wrote to many, many organizations, 20, 30, 50, one of them told me 125. And we were the only ones that said, yes, we will take you whenever you get out.
Catherine Catcher is the founder and executive director of Root and Rebound, a re-entry advocacy center in Berkeley.
I mean, when you leave prison or you leave jail, you get a certain amount of money. In prison, it's, you know, supposed to be $200 and a bus ticket, and that's it. The state doesn't take care of your housing. They'll put you on parole. Parole doesn't pay for housing. Probation doesn't pay for housing. You're expected to pay for your own housing, but you don't have the money. So it just doesn't exist. And so people end up on the streets very, very quickly.
She says that the few programs that do get funding tend to focus on substance abuse.
But what happens is that the men and women that will apply to that and get into those programs, they don't belong there. It's an inappropriate place for them to be. And they're taking up space for people who might actually need to be there. But look, they need a place to live. And they're not able to go and get jobs or, you know, go to school because they're in very restrictive housing because they supposedly have a substance abuse problem.
Some people like William and John, who served long prison sentences, already spent decades in drug recovery programs while they were in prison.
The burden that they have to show in order to get out from the Board of Parole hearings, this kind of true rehabilitation and complete insight and remorse about everything they've done. I mean, these people are the most rehabilitated and wise and prepared people when they come out, because they've spent years and years inside and they've decided that they, if they ever have the chance to be free again, they're going to be grateful and they're going to work hard and they're going to give back to their communities.
In 2013, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, or CDCR, found that people who were sentenced to serve up to a lifetime in prison were six times less likely to return to prison as people who served shorter sentences. And of about 1,000 people who are paroled after serving sentences in California of first or second degree murder, zero have committed another murder. William and John are both eager to get their own place, but it's not easy. Many landlords require rental or credit histories, which someone who has spent most of their life in prison cannot show. And housing in the Bay Area is expensive. So the men need to find steady, well-paying jobs before they can earn enough money to move. As we walk out of the Options house, William tells me how much he wants to have his own apartment.
I save a lot of money there, but it's just not. It's time to move on.
A few months go by. I check in with the guys to see how they're doing. William has moved on from Options. He found steady work and an affordable studio apartment in San Leandro. I go to visit him at his new place.
You're the first one I ever came here.
I'm the first one.
So far, yeah.
Can you give me a tour?
All right, that's the kitchen.
Got a lot of Raiders, Raiders cups.
There's 12 there and about 20 more in the cabinet.
It's for Raiders party.
yeah. And that's my grandmother right here, my dear. That's the one that really helped me plant the seed to forgive. And that's my daughter. That's when I first got out. The first time I'm seeing my daughter out here, I took her to the movies. That's one of the pictures.
So can you describe to me what it's been like living in your own place, like ever? Because is this the first time you're living by yourself?
Yeah, other than prison cell.
Yeah. The first time ever?
This is the first time ever. I was only 17. I stayed with my mom before I went to prison. So this is my first time being on my own, freedom, you know, and it felt real good, you know, to be able to come here and close the door and not have nobody here, you know, solitude and think and, you know.
William tells me that having his own space is one of the best parts of leaving prison and Options Transitional Housing.
It felt like a place where I could crawl into and just really sleep. Because all these other places in prison, I haven't been able to really sleep because people will either get up and, like in prison, you have some cells, most of them have toilets inside of the room. So your cellie could get up at any time while you're sleeping at night and use the restroom. And when he flushed that toilet, that's that wakes you up. And out here, you know, people come in and out of rooms and going in their boxes or plastic, you know, and waking me up. So I was never able to sleep. And here, the only thing waking me up here, sometimes I can hear Bart, but it sounds good. I can hear the train, but it sounds good, you know. It's a different sound.
John is still living in Options. Unlike his friend, he has not been able to find a job that pays enough for him to afford his own place. Options recently moved him to a different apartment in Oakland. We meet at a nearby park where he describes it to me.
It's a one-bedroom apartment, and it has five guys in it. And it's a one-bedroom, but they use the living room as a bedroom with three guys in there, you know. And it's just cramped. It's too much, you know. I mean, I can't stand it, you know. I have one guy, he snores real loud, you know, and it's just being around people, you know, being back in that environment where you're living with guys like that, you know. I was in prison for all those years, and I never got into a fight. I never used drugs or alcohol. You know, I followed the rules. You know, I got my education. You know, I did everything I needed to do to get out of prison. You know, I don't like coming out of prison in that control environment and then being in another control environment, you know.
Limited housing options are a huge hurdle for people reentering. Section 8, for example, bans people with certain types of offenses from living in public housing. And private landlords are permitted under law to discriminate against people on the basis of their criminal records, as long as it doesn't violate other civil rights laws. Until there are more housing programs for people reentering, they will have to do the best they can with what's available. For Cross Currents, I'm Louisa Beck.
Next week, we'll continue our series on reentry by looking at the challenges of finding a job.
There's a huge stigma against them, and because they've committed a crime, especially if it's a violent crime, they're going to find it extremely difficult to get any kind of gainful employment.
Formerly incarcerated men look for work. That's next Wednesday on Cross Currents. Last week, we looked at some of the ways realignment is shaping reentry programs in the Bay Area. Here's how some of you responded to that show.
Hello, my name is Linda Gross. I wondered if you might be interested in the story of the good work that Goodwill does. They're one of the few organizations that actually employs former felons and helps them to get that record cleaned up. Helps them to get into programs and into trainings that bring them into jobs. And they do so at a greatly reduced cost than keeping those people in prison.
Next message.
Hi, it's Denise DeBras-Vigil. What would keep people who get let out of prison from not going back to prison? First of all, it would be education. In the spectrum sense, which is what all of humanity needs, which is mental health, the understanding of some simple things, such as what it takes to be happy, and learning how to resolve conflicts within your important relationships.
We really appreciate hearing from you and want to keep this conversation going. So what do you think is the best way to help people who have been in prison make a clean start? Give us a call and let us know at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. The Bay Area is constantly evolving. From the gold rush to Silicon Valley, from boom to bust and back again, it can feel a little like deja vu. Back in 2000, just before the dot-com bubble burst, unemployment in San Francisco was at an all-time low of 3%. It's nearing that again, approaching what economists call full employment, meaning, statistically anyway, there are jobs for everyone who wants one. But what story do these numbers really tell? Where is the job growth, and who's benefiting? A recent study shows that the gap between rich and poor is growing faster in San Francisco than in any other city in the country. Tracy Groves works with the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. I asked her if San Francisco is leading California's economic surge, and if that resurgence goes beyond tech.
Yes, and yes. So what's driving it right now in San Francisco, we've got construction, we have professional services, computer systems design. So tech, obviously, is a big piece of this, but it's not the whole story. And what we've seen over the last year is leisure and hospitality also growing quite robustly.
So, I mean, it seems like the jobs that you mentioned, if they're driven by these large tech firms primarily, then a lot of the other things, leisure, hospitality, for example, that these other industries are the ones that are benefiting to some extent because of the growth in tech.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it goes even beyond that. If you imagine a tech company expanding here or a new one opening up here with 40 to 100 people, well, those 40 to 100 people are not all engineers. You've got accountants, you've got HR people, you've got office managers, you have executive assistants. You've got a whole range of job opportunities.
Does that mean you need to have big companies in order to drive unemployment levels down because they will end up having quite a variety of jobs that support them?
You know, I think it depends on the location. You know, we have a very vibrant ecosystem here for entrepreneurial growth, and it thrives in this dense connection of talented individuals and research facilities and such. So Twitter expanding on mid-market, I think that was very effective in creating a magnet to that part of town. San Francisco already had so much going for itself. You know, that really worked. I think, you know,
they were the anchor tenant.
Exactly. Yeah. But that model wouldn't necessarily work just in any place. I mean, San Francisco is hot right now, and that is really driven by this demographic shift we're seeing. You know, young technical talent, they want to be in urban centers. They don't want to be out in the suburbs. In fact, these folks don't even want to drive. So that is, you know, a major driver for these companies who are targeting this young technical talent to move here. You know, I've been spending a lot of time out in the Tri-Valley lately at the labs and talking to businesses out
What's
there.
What's the Tri-Valley? I'm sorry.
Oh, that's Livermore, Pleasanton, Dublin, San Ramon.
There's the East Bay where there's a lot of headquarters of places. I know, for example, like Chevron is San Ramon, aren't they?
Exactly, yes. But in Livermore, you also have two national labs. But they have opened up what they do, and they're working more and more with businesses, and not just businesses in Livermore, but, you know, big technology companies throughout the Bay Area. Anyway, so they're dependent on young technical talent as well. And so I was surprised to hear that so many of their young engineers and scientists are commuting to Livermore from San Francisco. So then we start hearing about ideas about expanding BART to Livermore. Well, you say, well, of course, it's all part of one regional labor market.
So is this something that can often drive government policy then when the economy is booming at times, when the unemployment rates are low and we have different housing and transportation issues? Can that drive government behavior?
Yeah, when our demands come to a peak like this and movement becomes so difficult, for sure, these issues become top of mind for decision makers. The problem is that these projects take a lot of time to develop and, you know, get through all of the CEQA and all of the other regulatory requirements and everything. It's like we're always playing catch up.
That's Tracy Groves. She's vice president of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. So if we're always playing catch-up and governments are behind in making sure the jobs are available and the infrastructure is in place, then what do you think is missing? What do you think could help?
What we haven't seen yet is really hearing the viewpoint of the employers and the business community on where they see the opportunities for job growth and where they see the specific requirements for achieving those job gains. So, I mean, we're seeing growth in high-end earners, job opportunities, and growth in the low end. It would be very wise for us to be very proactive in that middle area. So how can we encourage career ladders? How can we work together to not just be filling low-end jobs, but thinking about development and how people can share in the growing regional prosperity?
So as long as you're here and talking about that, how do you solve that middle issue? Because I think that the biggest concern that people have really is that the top is growing, but the bottom is spreading. San Francisco and the Bay Area, certainly San Francisco, have the widest spread of that's happening right now.
Yeah.
And so the middle is disappearing, and this is a huge overriding concern.
It's very concerning for our future success and prosperity.
Well, so what would
We've
you
got
advise?
To address that.
What
well, the first thing I would advise is let's talk to employers, the hiring managers, people who are making those decisions day to day about whether they're hiring or not hiring and what kinds of positions they want to fill. Let's get those people in the room with the talented people we have at our workforce investment boards in the region and at the community colleges and the talented people we have at our high schools. Let's get everyone around the table to talk about that.
Do you have an example of that happening?
Oh, yeah. The Bay Area has a number of great projects underway. Let's see, Skyline College, I know, has a project going on where they are working together with tech companies in their food services and connecting tech companies with a variety of people from high schools and other places to get them trained in these areas and in worthwhile jobs.
So this is basically public-private partnerships.
For sure.
Including educational institutions, which is where young people who are trainable and could be specifically target trained for the jobs that are emerging.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have a lot of talented people, working with workforce investment boards and community colleges, high schools, and even universities. But, they're focused on certain things. They're not focused on the same things that our local employers are focusing on, such as their changing markets and changing technology and how their demand for workers is shifting. So that's why we need to bring these people together. And I love this work with these engagement processes. When you bring talented people from different parts of the economy and the community together, because then you see all these ahas burst out in the room where people realize, hey, we could work together and really make a difference, because we know employers are having trouble finding the people with the right skills. We know there's a strong demand for skilled trades people. We've got a major issue with replacement jobs. There's a whole wave of baby boomers on the verge of retirement, and we don't have enough electricians and plumbers and other folks in the pipeline to fill a lot of these jobs with utilities and such.
So it seems like essentially kind of a big jigsaw puzzle in a way. I mean,
right.
The pieces don't necessarily match the openings, but if people are trained appropriately and these partnerships and the communication is there, then people can all find spots within what you're calling the ecosystem.
Right, yeah. And it's not just about getting that training and moving on with one's life. The reality is that the economy is changing at a quickening pace. And so we all have to be prepared for continually upskilling and retraining.
Do you see this happening then in a way that is going to be benefiting all levels of society, all different income groups and such, that the proper training is happening, the access to this education and to the knowledge of what jobs are emerging?
Yeah, no, I think we still have a lot of dots to connect. And I think that there's a lot we can still do to create a more resilient community.
Tracy Groves is Vice President of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. You can find more information about the programs she was talking about at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Lisa Carmack, Audrey Dilling, Rachel Dornhelm, Nina Ginsler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Suki Lewis, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ted Muldoon, Ryan Miller, Stephen Short, Liza Veal, and Melanie Young. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer was Leela Day. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chian. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, and because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. The song you're hearing now is by Jesse Di Natale from Sonoma. He'll be performing a benefit concert this Sunday at Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station. Music starts at 7 p.m. The cause is worth checking out, too. Learn more at our website, kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney. I know every face.